Have you ever wondered how elite investors and millionaires and billionaires that we hear about consistently avoid paying taxes? Although they come under scrutiny when they're in the public spotlight, let's be honest, wouldn't you like to pay no taxes? In this episode, Greg Fife walks us through some of the strategies CPAs of the ultra wealthy use to help them avoid paying taxes legally with their real estate investments. We'll learn more about that and the future of what's on the horizon in terms of real estate investment taxes in this episode, but first, our intro. This is Building Passive Income and Wealth Through Real Estate, where we guide you through the relentless pursuit of financial independence. I'm your host, Justin Moy, managing partner at Perpetual Wealth Capital, a multifamily real estate investing firm that lets everyday people invest passively in income-producing apartment buildings. Hey, investors, welcome to another episode of Building Passive Income and Wealth Through Real Estate. Today, I'm sitting down with Greg Fife. Now, Greg is a real estate investor and tax specialist whose goal and mission is to help real estate investors navigate the tax landscape. And he's here today to tell us about some upcoming tax changes and what real estate investors should know and how they can adapt to what's coming in the pipeline. Greg, thanks so much for having me here, and we're excited to have you.
Thanks, Justin. Yeah, happy to be here.
So quickly, just tell us, you know, a little bit about your background and your history and how we ended up meeting here today.
Absolutely. So I'm a CPA, been working in taxes for 5 years. Before that, I had some entrepreneurial business experience, and I was growing a company, found a CPA who really helped us shelter our money, and I just started to see the value and understand the CPA world and thought it was pretty neat. Ended up doing a career change to get involved to help other small business owners, investors. And so that's what I want to be. I want to be a tax advisor. I want to come alongside people and give them that peace of mind. They don't have to know everything, but that's what we spend our time doing. I've been doing real estate, focused on that for the last couple of years, living here in the Bay Area, San Francisco. Real estate's very expensive. We found that as a young family starting out, we are kind of priced out of the market, started looking for long-term investing, came across Bigger Pockets and got introduced to this whole real estate investing world, and simultaneously at the same time serving real estate clients in our firm and recognizing, wow, look at all these tax advantages. They're getting these depreciation write-offs and there's all these special 1031s, and got involved, thought I was going to buy some single family residence homes. Ended up pulling out and found out that a lot of people who start with single families end up more in apartments and syndications. And so I started looking at duplexes and fourplexes, but I also discovered syndications. And that was something I actually connected with you, Justin, through the Michael Blanc mentorship program. Got involved with a buddy, and we've been educating and doing a deep dive in syndications and focused on the Memphis market and some other non-California markets. But I love real estate. I see that as my long-term wealth building strategy. I love talking with real estate investors, and super excited to be here.
Similar to me, I mean, I'm from the Bay Area as well. We're actually not too far from each other where you're at from where I grew up. And so same as you, getting priced out and just decided this isn't what life is about, is struggling to pay rent no matter where I go here. So ended up moving out here to Arizona, which I found that balance to be much better. What are some of the best advantages for real estate investors in terms of taxes? Because yeah, taxes is definitely not something that I think anybody should do on their own. If they're in this space, it is just impossible to keep up with everything that's going on. So what are some things that you're seeing? You mentioned quite a few, you know, depreciation and cost segregation. You know, tell us a little bit of a deeper dive of those topics.
Absolutely. So just kind of like basic would be having a cash flowing asset. So you're making money, but you're not paying any taxes on it. You have the depreciation that is a non-cash write-off, potentially even putting you in a loss. So the most advantage would be more for what on the tax side is called the real estate professional. So if you're a real estate professional, then you're allowed to take these tax losses and actually write it off other types of income, whether it be salary, wages, other types of business income, investment income, interest, dividends, capital gains, anything like that. That is a class of investor that gets the most advantages for the tax losses that real estate can generate. And you and I, we talked earlier, the cost segregation study is one additional vehicle that you can really amp up those losses and take bigger losses in earlier in the life of the investment, as opposed to spreading the depreciation loss equally out over time, cost segregation allows for a larger year one or whatever year you have the cost segregation done. So that's a great strategy planning tool. There's also 1031 exchanges when you want to exit a property and you can defer recognizing the gain at that time. And in certain circumstances, that is a great strategy depending on who's invested in the property and their goals and whether they need the capital or not. One of the troubles I see out there is there's books out there and there's different people that advertise different strategies, and some real estate investors get caught in their head, oh, this will work for me too. But unfortunately, the way that the tax code is written, you have to qualify for certain benefits, and it's not something you want to wing or do on your own.
Start from the first point you said. So the real estate professional status, that's where you're going to get the most benefit. Tell us about that. And you said that you can actually, I guess, claim more loss if you have that status. And anybody who's listening, this will happen more so in commercial properties where taxes are more sophisticated. If a seller actually shares their profit and loss statements, sometimes you'll see that they're claiming actually huge losses every year because they have depreciation, they have interest expenses, they have all those things. Now, that doesn't mean the property or they are losing money, but it's what you're talking about. That's actually what they're giving to their CPA. That's what their CPA is giving to them. They're claiming those paper losses. But to claim that real estate professional status, tell us about that, because you mentioned it can offset things like wages or regular W-2 earnings. How can people qualify for real estate professional status so they can get all those benefits?
This is a highly scrutinized qualification and status by the IRS. So it's not a loophole. It's not something where you want to be too loose about this. You want to make sure that you have the documentation to support that under an audit. One of the things we're going to kind of touch on briefly too is some of the tax law changes and the new tax environment, given the change in administrations and their goals and everything that they're bringing forth. And one of the things is, I think it was about $43 billion or something to that tune where the Congress was going to fund the IRS for enforcement. Yeah, they're hiring a lot more agents. They're doing more trainings. They're going to be scrutinizing taxpayers' tax positions a whole lot more. They've been kind of like running bare bones for the last couple decades. There's a couple different hurdles and aspects of the status that you have to meet. And the first one is you have to be spending more than 750 hours a year materially participating in an active trader business that is in a field that the Congress has recognized as being a real estate professional field. If you're like a real estate agent, a broker, doing anything related to building property, selling properties, or managing properties, if you're a property manager, if you're actively involved, spending time that materially matters to the efficiency of that property, the management of that property, then these are hours that you can count as a real estate professional. So you have to have more than 750 hours during a tax year. And it's an annual election. So every year you look at your activities and your services and you have to qualify. That's one aspect of it. The second one is more than 50% of your personal service time has to be involved in a real estate professional activity, trader business. So if you have those two things, more than 750 hours, and then you have more than 50% of your time is spent on real estate trader businesses, then you are a real estate professional. Now, here's a little bit of a trap too, is so you might have like some real estate agents and that's all they do. They're real estate agents. They're going to meet the 750 hour and more than 50% of their time test.
Right.
Now they go and they buy some rental property. Now let's just say they live in California like me and they say, hey, it's too expensive out here. I'm going to go buy another part of the country. So they buy those rentals out there. Now they think, I'm creating these rental losses. I'm going to be able to offset my real estate income. That's false. You're a real estate professional. Now you have to materially participate in the properties that are generating losses for you. So basically a material participation hour for a rental property, what is it? If you don't do that hour of material participation, then the management of the property is going to be impacted negatively. If I review the financials for 1 hour, is that a material participation in my rental property? No, because actually you doing the review of the financials didn't necessarily have any impact on the quality of that rental operation.
So you'd have to be doing things like screening tenants or managing contractors to come and value add the property. A lot of investors, especially out of state, will have a property manager. And it sounds like that property manager is going to take up a lot of those hours.
Yep.
But the owner should be overseeing or, I guess, managing those managers. So I guess that gets a little tricky, is how do you really define that? And what does the IRS really expect? Because it's kind of like having that old stack of receipts in a shoebox somewhere. I mean, and nobody really does that anymore. You know, are they expecting that? And how can investors who have a property manager, how does that impact things?
When you have a property manager, it makes an even tougher case to prove that you are materially participating. Because like you said, the person who gets the material participation hours is the one who's actively doing it. So if you're there watching your property manager make the repairs or work with contractors, then that's not going to count as a material participation hour for you. For that property, it's going to be the person that's getting their hands dirty, for lack of a better word, but the person involved doing the work. So in order to qualify for material participation, you have to essentially be a property manager. You have to be involved in self-managing your properties. The test for material participation, there's like 7 different tests that you can qualify for. Kind of the gold standard is 500 hours. If you spend yourself 500 hours materially participating in your rental properties, then you can take that loss against other sources of income. And so like, even if you have one rental property and you're the full-time property manager, are you going to be able to get 500 hours throughout the year from that one property? And depending on the property and everything, chances are probably not. That real estate agent scenario, and maybe they have 4 or 5 rental properties that they self-manage locally. So whenever you start buying properties further away from where you reside or where you work, it just raises more flags for the IRS. And unfortunately, if you ever get into a tax court situation, you're not going to have much of a leg to stand on. They're just going to start pulling it apart.
How, I guess, specific, because you had mentioned, hey, if it does go to that level, which I don't wish that on anybody really, but they are going to really dig into what you did, what your hours got to. How in-depth do your notes or your records need to be? I mean, is it income-based? If you're saying, hey, you know, I made only $100,000 last year and $80,000 were from the rentals, therefore, I mean, you kind of defer that that's where most of my attention goes. What does that record keeping look like?
One more important thing in that scenario where the real estate agent owns the 4 different properties, the reason you can get to that like 500 hour threshold of material participation hours is because you can make a grouping election. So it doesn't have to be 500 hours per property. But if cumulatively on all of your real estate investment portfolio, you spend 500 hours materially participating, managing those properties, then you can group them. A lot of benefits to that. More often than not, 9 times out of 10, people should be making that election and getting those tax benefits. Okay, so to your question, it's kind of a case-by-case status of potentially like best practices. What I'm going to talk about is what is being allowed in the courts and what's being disallowed. So from a court perspective, we'll start with like what's the highest standard, and it may not be realistic, but the highest standard would be to, we'll just go back to that real estate agent. If all you do is you make income as a real estate agent, and then you have these portfolios on the side, you have no other job, you might not need to necessarily track all of your hours as a real estate agent. To show more than 50% of my time is in real estate professional activities. Now, if you had like a second job, then you would definitely want to track both hours. You have to support that you have the hours for a real estate professional, and then you also have to support that it's more than 50% of your time. So if you only track 50% of your time in real estate professional, the courts are going to say, well, you can't substantiate how much time you spent in this other activity. So in that case, you definitely want to be tracking both hours, and you need to have these really detailed records. If there's any chance where you're having a W-2 job and then also trying to claim the status doing some real estate work, you're the person that needs to actually get this detailed and this meticulous with your notes, just for to have your day in court and say, hey, I did my job. I'm ready.
And I imagine the highest likelihood of the IRS saying, okay, this person, I'm sure they filter that out as the first people to look at as the people who have a W-2 and then also claiming this status.
So exactly
to think of as well. I want to talk about something that you had mentioned before as another one of the benefits, and listeners may have heard of it, may have not, but cost segregation. Which anybody who really has no idea or never heard of that term, cost segregation, essentially you can depreciate assets over the life of the property. And cost segregation is a means of essentially expediting that and taking more loss in the beginning. You mentioned maybe 1 to 3 to 5 years instead of over the course of the property. So tell us about cost segregation. And most of the time when people are using it, they're selling these properties in a couple of years because it's not that they are not paying taxes. It's more so that they're kind of kicking the can down the road. They'll just pay them later and then that tax will eventually catch up to them. So if somebody has a property and they're buying it long-term and their goal is to hold it for 10, 20, 30, forever, is cost segregation still something they should do or should they just pay their taxes as they go and then not have that huge bill coming up in the future?
I think everybody's goals, objectives, business plans are so different. So it's not universally the right thing to do. It has to make sense for your situation. The basic idea, I'm sure your listeners probably being real estate investors are familiar with cost seg, but I'll just give a quick brief overview for those who aren't. Yeah, so the cost segregation study, generally, let's just say you buy a rental property for $1 million. What the tax code allows you to do is depreciate that over 27 and a half years. So you can reclaim the value as the property gets through wear and tear, you get to recognize the deduction. Now, a cost segregation study, what that does is it says, well, we're going to break down this building to different year lives. So like a light fixture, you know, that might have a 5 year, the flooring might be 7 years. So you can look at a building and say, not everything in here is going to last 27 and a half years. That's more the structure of the building. Right. You break down a property down to its different class lives. So 5 year, 7 year, 15 year property, and then the 27 and a half. Generally, what we see is about 30% of a building will be fall into these shorter class lives. Now, currently under the current tax law, there's an additional benefit on top of that where you can take expense 100% of that property. So basically for that $1 million property, we'll say 30% of that has these shorter class lives. Now 30% of that, you can get a deduction in year one. $1 million property, generally $300,000 of tax depreciation losses. So whether that loss can be claimed by the investor or not, if you're a real estate professional, you could offset other income with that. If you're not a real estate professional, you can offset other passive rental income. And if you don't have passive rental income, then it gets limited. You're not able to take that loss in the year that you're claiming it, but it gets carried over to future years to either offset future passive income or on the year that you sell it, you can recognize all of the passive losses that haven't been recognized at that point.
Got it. So when should investors not participate in a cost segregation study or not have that done on their property?
The benefit is really limited if you're not a real estate professional and you don't have other passive sources of income. So if you just have a single resident that's truly passive to you and it's just going to be limited, it may not make a lot of sense to take that. Kind of what I've seen too is a smart strategy around the cost segregation study is the first 6 months of the year, look at selling your properties. The second 6 months of the year, look at buying your properties. Because now the year that you sell, you're going to have potentially a gain that you're going to recognize. So if you sell the first year, you're going to get an idea of how much that gain is. Now you're going to spend the second half of the year looking at properties that you can buy that will produce potentially a cost segregation loss to offset the gain, minimizing your tax bill. So that's one effective strategy I've seen around the cost segregation study is timing the selling and the buying in the same year. You don't really want to sell at the end of the year because if you buy in January the next year, it's two different tax years. You're not going to be able to like have that cost seg loss flow through to offset the income.
Absolutely. So that timing is super important. And I'm glad you mentioned that because it's something that is a pretty crucial thing to miss. And it could be a very costly decision that just a few months has. So that's incredible. So great value there. Now tell us about the future of tax. I know it's ever changing and with new administrations, people tend to, I guess, I don't know if panic is the right word, but Joe Biden specifically has really made a stance to come after investors and come after people of certain wealth. So tell us a little bit about the future of tax law and what's kind of on the table now.
I'll just start with kind of my overall philosophy on tax law. I know it's this kind of intimidating topic to talk about, and it can strike fear in the hearts of people of thinking about taxes and this overwhelmingly big Internal Revenue Code. The way that the tax law is written is that every dollar of income you make, no matter the source, is taxable unless there's some sort of provision in there that allows it to be non-taxable. And every expense you have is non-deductible, so you don't get a tax benefit for it unless there's some sort of tax code provision in there that allows somebody to have a deduction, a tax benefit. Just with that perspective, the way that I see it is that the Congress tries to incentivize private individuals to organize their affairs, their activities, spend their time doing certain things. And if you do these things, then you get these benefits. So it's actually a very like patriotic thing you could do. So there's three areas that Congress has really incentivized. The first one is housing. Everybody needs a place to live. If you spend time making nice places for people to live here, then Congress will encourage that. Everybody needs a house. The second area is a job. Everybody needs jobs. So if you're somebody that's like an entrepreneur and you want to go out and you want to build companies that generate income, provide for people places to work, get paid well, all those things, then they're going to incentivize business owners. So jobs and property. And then the third area has been around energy. So historically, it's been like gas and oil. There's tons of tax benefits for investors or people involved with gas and oil operations. What we're seeing with Biden and the green push. There's a lot of incentives also around building houses green or cars, electric, all of that. Those are the three core things that historically the tax code has provided benefits for. With that in mind, looking into what's currently going on, the House did pass on November 19th the Build Back Better Act, and it's currently sitting with the Senate, what they call a budget reconciliation bill, which just requires a simple majority in order to pass. And so right now it's a 50-50 Senate between Republicans and Democrats, but you have the vice president who's able to come in and be the tie-breaking vote. So it is Democratic controlled. Yeah. A single person can break party line. If one person does break, then no bill can get passed. So looks like there's a little bit of negotiations going on, trying to get everybody in agreement. There are some concerns. And so anyways, we'll see whether or not it passes by the end of this year. I think that President Biden has come out and said that's his goal. Let's try to get it by the end of the year. But he wants it passed regardless. But yeah. I think there is kind of a push right now. Let's try to do something before the year end. So we'll see if this actually passes before the year end. So we can talk a little bit about what's in the bill. And we'll start off with, you can't do any tax planning as they're proposing bills or earlier drafts. You have to actually wait until it's signed into law. You never know what's going to end up in the bill. And it seems like a lot of times there's a lot of talk when an administration comes in with things that they're going to do and what they're going to change. But at the end of the day, a lot of that stuff doesn't actually happen. A word of advice, don't get scared and don't go sell your properties or get concerned over drafts of bills. You got to wait.
We'll know in maybe a month or so, or maybe 2 months, about what's going on, what's actually going to be getting passed and what's going to be in the Build Back Better Act.
So I know a lot of people do invest through their self-directed IRA. So that's a strategy that's still intact. So anyways, all this was good news. We still have 1031 exchanges, the same long-term cap gains, same stepped-up basis. A lot of the same strategies around real estate are still intact. Yeah. So
is there anything on the horizon that is kind of that negative that anybody should at least be aware of that's still up for grabs, that's still being talked about? What's maybe the one thing that could be the biggest concern that real estate investors should really look out for to see in the next, when this law gets passed, if that made it in or not?
Certain real estate professionals, depending on certain activities, an S corporation has been a little more tax efficient vehicle than a limited liability company. It's primarily if you're dealing with active ordinary income. So this might have to do with like flippers, wholesalers, other people who are having self-employment income. So an S corp historically has saved you about 3.8%, as there is no self-employment tax on the pass-through income through an S-corp. So there's a little bit of a game where, as an S-corp, if you own 100% an S-corp, you have to pay yourself wages, then you can also take tax-free distributions, and you're saving some payroll taxes by being able to organize your properties that way. So one thing that this Build Back Better Act currently has in there is that there's going to be a 3.8%, the net investment income tax is now going to apply to business income as well. The one thing about this, though, too, is if your taxable income is greater than $500,000, if you're married filing jointly, or $400,000, through real estate investing, if you're getting big depreciation losses, keeping your income below that certain threshold, then this may not apply to you. But once your taxable income exceeds that, then this additional 3.8% tax will be added on.
Got it. So that's something to keep aware of, listeners. So in the next couple of months, we'll know how these things are playing out, but always important to keep your finger on the pulse of what's coming up and what the changes are out there, and keep in touch with your CPA or guys like Greg who can come and help you out, know all these things on your behalf. So Greg, before you head out of here, I would love to ask you, what is the biggest mistake that you see real estate investors make when it comes to taxes, tax season, or maybe being prepared for taxes? And how can they avoid those mistakes?
Probably one of the biggest mistakes is people kind of have this concept that a CPA might have such a broad knowledge base, but CPAs are more specialized. There's a lot of tax benefits on the table for real estate investors. And historically, this industry has had more of a generalist mentality where a CPA will try to practice in as many different areas as possible. But what we're seeing is that there's a lot of missed opportunities, missed tax savings, especially with real estate. That's kind of how we win a lot of new clients, actually, is just looking at their prior tax returns and saying, wow, look at all these opportunities on the table that were missed. You definitely want to make sure that you're talking with a CPA who has the specialized deep knowledge in real estate, just because of all the additional benefits that are on the table, and you don't want to miss out on any of those. And you also don't want to claim any benefits if you don't really qualify, put yourself in risk that way. So the other thing is, as far as like a smooth tax season goes, getting your tax return prepared, providing your information early is probably like great advice, because if it's kind of last minute, either people might be disappointed if the tax return can't be completed on time, just because there's such a high volume of tax returns coming in around the same time. So you don't want to make any mistakes or things like that. So we kind of ask that information be provided at least like a month before the deadline, just to ensure that we have time to go back and forth. There's always questions. Try to maximize the deductions, and there might be questions about an activity, or just making sure that we have all the pieces of the data together so we can just make sure that we're getting all the benefits possible.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. Well, listeners, thank you so much for listening to the show. Greg, one last thing. How can people get a hold of you?
Yeah. So my email address is probably the best way. It's going to be gfyfe@ssflp.com. Send me an email and we can be in touch.
Absolutely. We'll put that in the show notes. And listeners, while you're there in the show notes, if you haven't already, download our free ebook, The Definitive Guide to Building Generational Wealth and Passive Cash Flow Through Multifamily Real Estate. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.